Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. I can't believe another week has gone. I say this every week. I sound like a broken record, I'm sure, but it's really hard to believe we're already more than halfway through 2020, a year, an extraordinary year that is already going to be a permanent fixture in the history books. So I hope you are doing well. And thank you for choosing to share this corner of the internet with me. I have another glorious episode for you today. I know I say that every week. It's really lovely hearing your feedback from the episode I did with India Gary Martin last week. If you haven't tuned in, please do. It's full of such wisdom. I am feeling nourished after a nice slow weekend, and I was also indulging on WOW Festival. Women of the World Foundation did a 24-hour global festival having urgent conversations with people all over the world, including incredible civil rights activist Angela Davis. Angela, if you don't know her, my goodness, you need to catch up. Google, have a read. She's written, I think, she's author of 10 books as well, but she was campaigning alongside Martin Luther King Jr. And I think just hearing that and remembering that shows that this wasn't so long ago, and we're still campaigning and fighting for the same equity, the same race equity. And she was sharing with founder Jude Kelly about the current movement, and Jude was asking her if there's any difference, because obviously, given the huge role she played in bringing forth change in the height of the 60s, is there any difference? Are we going to see progress? And Angela's response to that was that she never, in the years that she's been an activist and in everything that she experienced and witnessed fighting for civil rights and the height of the civil rights movement in America in the 60s, she's never seen such global momentum and global conversations being had about Black Lives Matter. Hearing her say that was very, very inspiring. So like I always say to you, my friends, we are on the cusp of change, whether we like it or not, and we have the choice right now to play a conscious role in being part of that change or remaining complicit. And I just want to let that land with you. You should be able to go over to WOW Foundation, their website, and catch up on the 24-hour global festival. Just put WOW Global into Google and it should come up. There were conversations all over the world, Papua New Guinea, Australia, India, US, UK, Serbia, I mean literally everywhere, everyone having similar conversations about inequity and what we can be doing about it. I need to thank my patrons. So I'm seeing more of you coming, which is great. Thank you for your support. As ever, this episode has been possible to be edited professionally. I've not had to go in GarageBand bumbling around this week. I'm so happy about that. Every small donation really helps to see this podcast keep going. And I must, you know, I'm going to have to give you the caveat that this season is going to be ending. I think you've got another 4 episodes after this one, and season 1 will be ending. And I very much want to see season 2 continue later this year, and your donations will help that be the case. So thank you so much. And if you're hearing about Patreon for the first time, I will leave a link to the profile, because if you are learning and you're seeking value from this podcast and my work, and you want to support, then that's one way of doing it at an accessible price point. Equally, as ever, those of you who are ready to do this work properly, my anti-racism course is waiting for you. Literally there, ready to go for you to make change and be the change you want to see. So, not sure what you're waiting for, but it's there. Anyway, today, it's a pleasure to be having a conversation with Yazzie. Those of you who follow my work may already know of Yazzie. She's founder of Stand for Humanity. I don't know when Yazzie and I first met. It was online because we're both activists. She describes the work she does as race work. She does a lot of important work in terms of refugee crisis as well. And she's also a poet. This is a masterclass for you in anti-blackness, in white supremacy, in the importance of reparations. Oh, there's so much. There is so much gold in here. Enjoy the conversation. Some of it is going to challenge you. Sit with it, lean into it, rewind, listen to it again and again. Yazzy and I support each other on a regular basis because I think what is under, or perhaps not spoken about rather than underestimated, is the toll that being an anti-racism activist takes on you as a human being. And so it's important that you have a support network of other people who are doing anti-racism work in terms of activism, because I can't talk to my husband or to my friends who are black about the enormous amount of racism and fragility I receive often on a daily basis, because it triggers their trauma as well. So it's really important to have that community of other people doing this work, and I have that in Yazzy, I have that in Layla Saad, and others who we were regularly checking with one another. And it's really, really important. And actually Yazzy and I talk about the power and the importance of community, which is something that was also covered in the last podcast episode with India. So it's just feeling more relevant now more than ever. Yazzy and I really, really dive into anti-blackness that is present and is sort of coming to the surface in this Black Lives Matter movement. And anti-blackness is where you start to see specific race hate towards the black community that often comes from other ethnic minorities, including the South Asian community. And Yazzy and I are going there today. So buckle up. Learn, listen and laugh along with us. And as ever, let us know what you think. If this podcast resonates with you, please leave a review at Nova Reed Official and your favourite podcast host. Diving in. See you next time. Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. I cannot tell you how excited I am for this episode. I have with me the sensational founder of Stand for Humanity, spoken word artist and poet and soul coach. And if you haven't already guessed by now, the incredible Yazzy Min. Welcome.
What an intro. Thank you. I'm standing here like a four-year-old being like, woo.
Yes, you celebrate yourself. You know, we're going to be talking all the stuff today. We're going to be giving some real truths today. But yes. Thank you so, so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Can I start by asking, who are you beyond the roles that you play?
What a beautiful question. Oh, honestly, I am four-year-old Yazzy. That is who I am. She governs most of what I do. She has it all right, and she always did. She is sunshine. She is joy. Therefore, I am sunshine, and I am also joy. And I have such vivid memories of being four and remembering the energy I felt about wanting to do something about sad things in the world. This is like four-year-old brain. Wow. And so anytime it all gets too much, or the roles get too much, or just life gets too much, I go back to four-year-old Yazzy. I never stray away from her. She is who I am.
Wow. Who is she?
Who is she? She is a mischievous, joyful, excited by life explorer. Like, I still make myself laugh at how I can just stop in the street from seeing like a blossom tree, or you know, that childlike awe and wonder thing never left. I've never ever lost that. And she loves that. Even if I then like indulge in that more, gosh, like this is why I'm late to most places. That and stopping to speak to homeless people. That was something that I always did. Well, my mum always did. So that's just normal to me and my sister. We'd always chat with the person selling the big issue. Anyone that was homeless, we'd stop to just wave or smile or give some change. So they're the two reasons that I'm late to most places, and they're genuine reasons.
Yeah, it's the best reason in the world. What a gorgeous answer. I love how connected you are with your inner child. I think that's wonderful, because our inner child is often so wounded or repressed, and you're just right there connected. Wow, that is a Powerful answer. So take me back. Where did you grow up? What was life like growing up for you?
So I grew up in the Midlands, and I grew up in a very small town, very sweet and quaint. And there wasn't, I think at the time when I was a kid, there wasn't much going on. So I was never excited by, I think when you get to your teens, you start to feel, well, I started to feel a bit restless, and like the place was nice, but it was all like hanging baskets and flowers and libraries. And that was about it. But growing up from the younger years, I was surrounded by a lot of family. So Indian families are big anyway, as most people know. And I was very blessed enough to have all of my family in the same town. And then the other parts of my family were only about an hour away, still in the Midlands. So I was brought up with so much love and so much nurturing from all of those aunts and uncles and all of my cousins and the playing. And I do look back at those years like, you know, we were the last generation really that grew up without social media, without the internet. It was just free, innocent child play. And so in that respect, I always look back at my childhood with a massive fondness and gratitude, like endless gratitude, because the love that got poured into me as a kid, I'm still feeling overflowing. And I think that is how I'm able to do some of the really hard work that I do, because I have that as a resource. And I also feel like it's rude for that to stay in one person. I'm overflowing with it. Like, that is there to be given out. Like, it didn't make any sense to me. Yeah, I was very fortunate as a kid to just have lots of love.
I love that. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So as you sort of developed into your... into an older child or into your adolescence, how was it growing up as a British person who is also of Indian heritage in Britain?
So when it came to that part, I think I'm still unpacking all of that now. The town I grew up in was very white. The only diversity was white, just Indian people, and most of them were my family. and to be honest, and Indians are very good, or South Asians, should I say, although where I grew up, it was specifically Indians from a certain part of India, maybe. Our community building is next to none. Indians are very good at creating community and holding on to culture, holding on to, like, I grew up knowing from a very young age without anyone explicitly saying, you are Indian and British. And I always felt Indian first, because that was me. That I didn't know how to, and it's funny, isn't it? In the diaspora, we always talk about, oh, which one am I? And am I more this one than that one? And I never felt like I had to have that conversation with myself, because I was like, well, I know I'm Indian, even though I wasn't born there. I'm very Indian. And all of my ways and what I'm about. And I think the culture was so strong, but we were also very British. And for some reason, I didn't have that kind of confusion. The things that were harder were being Indian and loving my culture so much. Like, I was that little girl that didn't want to ever take off her lehenga, which is a long skirt outfit, as a kid after a wedding. I'd want to stay in it. So I'd stay in it and sit in the living room and go to sleep with my bindi on. And I didn't want to wear boring Western clothes. Actually, they just weren't sparkly. They weren't colourful. As a kid, like, I didn't get why I couldn't. And I once wore my bindi to school. And I said to the teachers, it was a piercing. And get this, for mischievous four-year-old me, I knew, because I'd had my ears pierced, and I knew that you weren't allowed to take the studs out for 6 weeks, otherwise the piercing would close. So I said to my teacher, barefaced, I can't take it out, miss, because I've got to keep it in for 6 weeks. And she was looking at me like, right, so you got that pierced, did you? And I was like, yeah, I did. And then I came home being like, got away with it. And my mum was like, after a week, I kept it on for the whole week. And it was bath time on the Friday. Mum was like, it's going to leave a black sticky mark. I wouldn't, you know, you're not going to be able to get it off. And I was like, I was sobbing in the bath, because I was like, no, she's going to know I lied about the piercing. My mum was like, yes, I'm pretty sure she knew. we had to keep our Indianness at home.
Where did you feel that?
And that
pressure. I think, where did you feel that from?
That was from school, from social situations, from the street I grew up on. Everything was fine and cool, and everyone was lovely and friendly as long as we were whitewashed.
Yeah.
And I understood that very early on, but I didn't know why, because actually all I wanted to do was leave my bindi on and wear my bright orange sparkly outfits. And I got that from my family as well. I could feel that. I could feel there was this, okay, but we do those things at home.
Yeah.
We do those things behind closed doors. We have our giant week-long big Indian weddings where it feels like you've been away on holiday with your whole family. Yeah. And then on the Monday, you go back to school like nothing had happened. And you tell people about it, but not too much, because it was almost like they couldn't handle all of the majesty. I don't know what it was, but it was always having to be played down. Could never just be in that joy. And it's funny, I used to have a friend who had lots of other friends that I was invited to their weddings. And I remember a Western wedding. So I've been to, how many weddings in my lifetime as an Indian person? I would say 200.
Oh my God, don't.
Ballpark figure, mate.
Come on. Honestly,
that's not an exaggeration. I would say about 200. And I've stopped going to many as I've got older. So just FYI, right? The obsession with weddings in South Asian culture is just something else.
That's another level.
But when I was older and I started going to friends' weddings, I was like, oh, I don't actually know what's appropriate to wear to an English wedding, because I only wear our outfits. And I was like, I'll just go in a sari then. And I thought, wow, how nice would that be to actually be able to wear them other places? And I got told explicitly by one of my friends at the time that, oh no, don't do that because you're going to upstage the bride.
Oh boy.
And I was like, what? I'm not wearing white. And she was like, yeah, but like, come on, like, your outfits are beautiful, but I don't know how the bride's going to feel about that. So I went and got a dress from Zara or something, but that just felt weird to me. And it reminded me again of the, okay, can't celebrate and be in our excellence or our joy too much in case it threatens what?
Makes white people feel uncomfortable.
Mm. Yeah.
And did that ever, I get the sense that it hasn't, but I want to ask the question anyway. Did that ever lead to feelings of any shame?
Oh boy, definitely. There was, I think, because I love my culture so much, and it genuinely is a massive part of who I am. That still didn't stop the fact that I was growing up in a very white town, and the norm was the very white norms. And so I remember a few times as a kid, and as a teenager, I think probably even more as a teenager, right? Because you care more then about what other people think of you, and the white boys definitely were not interested in brown girls, definitely not in the 90s. And I remember thinking, looking around at everybody in my class or in the playground and having this really surreal sensation of, how did I end up as the brown one? How did that happen to me? And that makes me so sad for that young girl. And I can see how that has still dripped into, or that feeling has come into places when I've been an adult. Yeah. And, you know, being the only brown person in the room, or being the only person in the room who isn't whitewashed, because there are plenty of BIPOC that, you know, have done what they have to do to survive, and they're in a room with you, but what do they say? Not all skin folk are kin folk.
Yeah, and I say not all black folk are woke. Because I guess, you know, to expand on that for listeners, is that we have been exposed to the same programming, the same social conditioning about what is normal, what is not, what is acceptable, what isn't, like standards around what hairstyles are acceptable in the office, at school. I've always been around Eurocentric norms, and my hair is Afro hair is not that. So we've all been exposed to the same programming, which is why, you know, some of us have internalized racism as well. It's unavoidable.
So yeah, there was shame, and especially when it came to body hair. My god, like I could grow a beard waiting for the bus, mate. Like, and that's Indian jeans, my friend. Like, we can grow hair.
Yasmin's hair is bloody gorgeous. Bloody gorgeous.
Yeah, I am grateful for the hair on my head, but when it comes to getting the waxing kit out,
it's a lot.
Exhausting. And I'm having my own rebellion as I've got older, and I'm really proud of it. And like my arms, for example, I have the most baby soft hairs on my arms, right? But they're I would say probably considered as long now to other people. I spent so many years shaving them. Somebody said to me, and it was so sweet, it's somebody who's not Indian, and they were like, I absolutely love the hairs on your arm. They are so what's Indian about you. And I was like, that was such, I mean, at the age I am, if that had happened to me as a teenager, would have gone into my bathroom and got the razor and got rid of all the hair. But it helped me to just reframe, like, that is what's so Indian about me and how beautiful. And I'm Sikh, so we're not meant to cut our hair or get rid of hair. Hair is a sign of what God's given you. And maybe that's because, you know, we know how to grow it. So it's like, just embrace it. Embrace all of who you are. And I always felt so upset that I was having to get rid of something that actually my culture and my faith and my people really honour.
Yes.
But that's something that is not only like looked down upon by everyone, it's a form of disgust.
For some people,
It's a massive form of disgust. And you're looked at disgusting if there's hair on your body, that's not your head. And so there was massive shame around that. I started shaving my legs, probably the same story as most women. Must have been year six. And that was because a boy, get this, that was because a boy, I'm not going to mention his name, but I do know it. He was one of those lads, you know, just typically trying to get a reaction. And he learned the word in my language, Punjabi, the word monkey. He learned that to shout at me about my hairy legs.
Wow.
And so that's what made me go get the razor. So I was like, no way. And I got cussed by a white boy. In my own language.
How old were you?
About my hairy legs. I was 11.
Yeah, I can't remember how old year six is. It's profound, these moments, how they stick like glue, don't they?
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. And I think the reason, I was trying to explain this to someone the other day, why it can't be compared to other forms of bullying, because as everyone would say, well, you know, as a kid, everybody remember those horrible remarks and they're always traumatic. And I'm like, yeah. And then have the layer on top of that, knowing that the system that you live in and the world that you live in is backed up by those very things that happened to you as a 10 or 11 year old.
Yeah.
And that is the way, that's not just a sign of a kid being harmful, just for the sake of being, you know, a kid, and kids do say some mean things. But knowing that actually, as you get older, that is backed up by a system that you live in.
Yeah.
So you can't compare it.
Yeah, it's racism. Stop trying to compare it with name calling. And, you know, it's not to say that name calling doesn't hurt, or, you know, body shaming doesn't hurt. Mm. It's not racism, and they are not comparable. Less like racism isn't homophobia. They are not
exactly
comparable. We need to, stop doing that. I guess that leads me nicely on to my next question. So I imagine most people listening to this will have heard of you, but for those that haven't, Yazzy is one of my fellow anti-racism activists out there on the front line doing the work to help cool people along this journey, to unlearn their own BS, to shine a spotlight on it. And so, like, we support each other. It can be really hard, a lot. And we deal with a lot of apathy
Yaffy's just stuck her tongue out and rolled her eyes. So my question to you is, how do you deal with constant apathy in this space when you're trying to get people to just confront their own bullshit, reduce harm, stop gaslighting us? How do you deal with apathy?
Nova, I'm not going to lie to you. Apathy is my biggest bugbear.
Yeah.
So my TED talk actually that I did is called Why Apathy is Our Biggest Threat.
Yes.
And that is what I truly, truly believe, that crazy politicians are actually not our biggest threat. Climate crisis is also not our biggest threat, because the earth is going to live with or without us.
Yeah, agree.
It might be hotter. There might be species that don't exist anymore. We might be one of those species that doesn't exist anymore, but the earth will still be here. She will adapt. She will create other ecosystems for new forms of life to be born. We won't be. So apathy is our biggest threat. We are sat here with, I mean, those of us that are ironically the smaller percentage of the world, with the privilege to be able to sit here today and speak through technology and be sat with roof over our heads, to be given all that privilege and to not be doing anything with it in 2020 or in any time in the 20th or 21st century is actually a bit of an insult to life. And it's not to say that you have to go out there and do all of the things and save all of the world, but absolutely everybody can do something. And I believe that we live in times where if you're not doing something, it doesn't matter how small it is, then there is something to be asked about why. And that is also why I started Stand for Humanity. So the whole point of the movement is that everybody takes it upon themselves to think of one thing they can do for the sake of another who is not in their circle. Do you know, I got told this from a friend of mine who I actually really love and respected. Love and respect. Who said, yeah, I'm going to spend more time with my nephew. That's going to be my pledge, that one thing I'm going to do for another. And I said, that's really wonderful. I just hope that you'd be able to do that for your nephew anyway. And this could be something that you could do outside of yourself and your circle. Like, I had to explicitly state, make a pledge to do one thing solely for the benefit of humanity, for something outside of your circle.
Yes.
Because, Nova, the thing about that is, when people are faced with somebody they don't know or a situation that is not familiar to them, and they're left as two people without job titles, without even like a relationship construct, so your nephew or your mom or anything like that, just two humans connecting on the sole basis that you're two humans that have shared this bit of time and existence with each other, nothing else. And you doing something for that human who doesn't know you and you don't know them, or maybe you do know each other, but it's something outside of your direct circle. And for you to give something to that human and the magic that happens in that interaction is actually what I believe can completely kill away apathy within us. Because you see how beautiful that connection can be, and what can come of that connection is a byproduct.
Yes.
But the actual connection itself, there's a beautiful saying, that when two people come together or about the idea of collaboration in itself, it's not 1 + 1 = 2. It's actually 1 + 1 = 2.5. Mm-hmm. There is, and that half is the magic, the bit that you don't really know how to describe, but it happens from that collaboration, from that connection, from stepping outside of you and your family and being like, you know what, this is something that I have the capacity to do. It can be as small as smiling on your daily commute to somebody else. I have this game I play on the tube where I don't get off my train or I don't finish my journey until I've made contact with at least one person and given them a smile. It doesn't matter if they don't smile back. That's fine. I'm there to just give them that smile. And it's been the most beautiful game to watch. Like, somebody else has then watched
they us, do it.
And then they do it. And then somebody else has seen it. And then I've watched a smile travel up a tooth carriage. And then I'm like, I've already done the most important thing of my day. Yeah. Off I go.
And you know, the most beautiful thing about that is we've become so disconnected because, you know, technology is great for some things, but it also, you know, how we use it also has made us become more disconnected or having those deep, meaningful connections with people. And we crave it. It's like it's part of the human condition to connect. Mm. So I'm not surprised it's contagious.
Yeah, exactly that. And so that's one way I deal with apathy is actually getting people to make a pledge and to see what it is they can do outside of them and their circle. And I do want to make the point very clear that this is for people that have the mental capacity to do so.
Of course.
Because I have been in places where I have absolutely not had that mental capacity to even just be kind to myself.
Yeah.
And get myself in the shower and make myself a meal. Like, that has been a whole mountain. Yeah, in some of the dark days. And so nobody's asking that of people. This is for people that have the mental capacity. In terms of race conversations and apathy, that I find I've come to, because this work is so demanding, and as women of colour, it's another level of demand. My self-care and my mental health protection and just my little four-year-old Yazzie bubble that I am just fierce about protecting her, at least, if I can't think about me. I have come to make a very clear boundary for myself in that if there are people that are hell-bent on not understanding the systems that we live in, it is not my job to beg them to get it.
Yeah, it's not our job to convince them. I learned that the hard way.
Yeah, I learned that partly the hard way and partly from having some golden advice from Rennie Edelage, which I think I told you about a few weeks ago. And that was, we were in a group circle of women of colour who were doing spokespeople work and often facing the media, and people were talking about, you know, how do we handle certain people who are really hell-bent on not getting it? And she just interrupted the conversation and said, why is this even being discussed? I don't understand. And somebody was saying, well, you know, it's really hard when you're in the spotlight and everyone's trying to, you know, ask all these questions and attack you and get the best of you. And she was like, no. You don't even turn up to the meeting with those people. We are going after the Guardian readers at best. That's all we're talking here. These are people that acknowledge white supremacy exists, or at least are keen to understand how it's affecting us and how it lives within them and how we can work together to dismantle it. But begging them to get it, that's not our job.
No. So I see my work as I am teaching those who have a desire and curiosity to learn more and get it and help to be part of the solution. I see it as their job to have those conversations with the quote unquote the Daily Mail readers, for example, because it might be frustrating. It might mean make them want to smash their head against the wall, but it is not going to trigger trauma as it does in us as women who are black or brown, women of colour, people of colour. And that to me is the reason why I do my work. Like, that's not my job to talk to them and call them in and to call out casual racism around your dinner table from your dad or your uncle. Yes. That's your job.
Oh, I've got goosebumps. My whole spine just
said, Yazzie's doing a dance. 4-year old Yazzie is doing a dance for me on screen. Oh. We're recording and she's standing and moving and it's glorious.
That right there. That's also what I say. And thank you for putting it like that, because you're right. It's never going to trigger trauma for them. Mm. And that is the key point, because I've often said similar, but not really making a point of the trauma. And that's what's really important to remember, because I often say, you know, I know it's hard, I know it's frustrating, I know you'll feel alone, and whilst that is a very similar feeling that we feel, if you're feeling that as a white person, it's never going to have a fraction of what it would take for a black or brown person to break down racism for somebody who is unwilling to learn.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, as hard as it is for you, and as hard as, you know, you would be empathetic and compassionate, and we love you for that. But if it's hard for you, imagine. I mean, it's impossible to imagine.
No, they will never. But it's the point of this is, it's unimaginable.
Yeah.
Times that by 100,000, 2,000 every day of your life. It's just, yes. It's not going to trigger trauma.
No.
It will trigger frustration, maybe mild level of anxiety or worry or fear of not being liked. That's not triggering trauma from racism.
No.
And that's their power.
Yes. Yes.
So can we talk a little bit, and I'll give you context in a minute. In fact, let me give you context now. So we've had these conversations before offline.
Mm-hmm.
And it came up again very recently. I did an Instagram post talking about the impact of, well, the huge exponential increase in racism towards East Asian community, Chinese community at the moment because of the current virus. Mm-hmm. And so I was calling people in to be accountable and to explore how this current situation is revealing their racism. And I was contacted by somebody who said, look, racism of any form to any person is unacceptable and we need to tackle it. I can't help but feel agitated. These aren't the words I'm paraphrasing, but I can't help but feel as black women that, one, we're the ones that statistically receive most abuse, depending on what evidence you're reading. She said, it makes me feel like we as black women are the ones who are always advocating for each other. And yet when we're receiving all of this abuse, nobody's speaking up for us. So I had to handle that with care. But it's a question we've had before, and it's a question, it's something I talk about on my anti-racism course, about that we have the grandparent is white supremacy.
Yeah.
And underneath that, we also have race hate. And I use the word race hate and prejudice.
Yeah.
Anti-blackness or, you know, anti-Indian, whatever. I use those words instead of racism because they are a byproduct of white supremacy. So I just wondered if we could just open up that conversation and see where we go with it.
Definitely. And I'm really glad you brought it up, because it's something that I talk about and think about a lot. And it's so, for me, as a South Asian woman, and I have light skin privilege compared to other South Asian women, and, you know, there's the hierarchy of colorism, and that's the whole
caste system,
interbred thing within white supremacy. And also the tool of white supremacy to keep us all separated from each other. And that actually goes back to a thought I had as a four-year-old. I'll come back to that. Remind me. A very innocent thought that I had. It wasn't anything. I'll come back to it. Sorry. Okay. But it's something that I feel a lot. And I feel like when I was talking to one of my friends a couple of years ago, and she's of mixed heritage, but her I think her mum is from Zambia. And she said to me, she was like, you've been out here talking about race and stuff before I even did it publicly. And again, I was four when I understood that this, I was, again, so it goes back to my four-year-old self. I was four when I understood I was other.
Yeah.
And I was four when I understood colorism, which is massive, really looking back. I understood there was a hierarchy, and I understood that I would still have privilege, and that black children would have it worse than me. And that is coming from a four-year-old. And I never understood why we all were united.
Yeah.
I don't mean united against white people. I just mean united in our quote-unquote otherness.
Yes.
I didn't understand that. And the thought I had as a four-year-old was, and this is very innocent, I'm repeating this as from the innocent mind of a kid, was it felt along the lines of, why don't all black and brown people like gang up together yeah. and then they can get rid of the baddies?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I don't mean that in, like, you know, to take down white supremacy like that. I saw the division. I saw the division and I never understood why. Mm. And one of my friends, sorry, I jumped. One of my friends who, her mum's Zambian, she said to me, and I love her, she's got like an international accent because she lived in Canada and all over the world. She's a girl of the world. And she was like, yo, where are your people at, man? And I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, yo, like black people, like we've been talking about this shit for like time, you know? And she was like, yo, your people have been oppressed too. Like bad, like, where are your people at? She was like, I only see you. And I was like, I know. Tell me about it. Where are they at? Too busy being whitewashed. Too busy trying to conform to the ideals because, you know what? There is a hierarchy there. And yeah. It's like, well, you know, we're not totally accepted by the white man. But if we can just, you know, do what we can so that we don't end up being really at the bottom of the pile. I believe that that is what goes on through other people of colours. Mindset, whether it's subconscious or not.
Yeah. I don't always think it's conscious.
No, I don't think it's conscious.
I believe that at the top is white, underneath that is white other.
Yeah.
Underneath that, Asian.
Yeah.
East Asian.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom is black and potentially Bangladeshi as well.
Yeah.
Everything else in the middle. Yeah. So there is this standing that, again, it's not always expressed, but it's felt, isn't it?
It's felt. And I think people would be lying if they said they didn't feel it, even if they're not conscious of it in themselves or not. If people in the Asian community said they didn't feel it, they'd be lying because it's definitely there. And if I felt it as a four-year-old, that's why I go back to that, because I'm like, I'm sorry, I was four.
Yeah.
And I could feel it. So don't tell me with your grown-ass self that you can't feel it, you know? Yeah.
And also, with the skin bleaching and everything else, the lessons that we were learning, that proximity to whiteness was better within our own community.
Safer. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, with the East Asian community, I don't know if you've read The Good Immigrant.
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God, please get it over. That book actually managed to, that was inspiration for my poem, Taste. And then the fact that Rennie released her book around not long after that then gave me the courage to share Taste. Oh. So those two books for me are just, and
game changers
for the UK as well. For a person of colour to read that in the UK, I think you would just love it. So there's a chapter in there. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the author, because each chapter is a different person of colour writing. And one chapter was written by an East Asian woman, and she was saying that East Asians are completely invisible in this country to even be considered as a separate race. Mm. And I've always felt that as a kid, because I had family in America, and the word Asian in America means East Asian.
Yes.
The word Asian in the UK means South Asian.
Yeah.
And that's weird. That was weird to me as well. And she was saying, you know, we're treated as a model minority and an invisible minority because there's often not even a box to tick for them. For example, when it comes to the forms, I think she even said it was just other.
Mm.
But I think East Asians make up the third biggest ethnic group in the UK.
I can have a look at the data and put it in the show notes.
Yeah. And so I do. And I remember thinking, yeah, you're right. And she said, you know, it's different in that we get praised for being this model minority, but also invisible. Yeah. And they like the fact that we are, they like the idea of East Asians being passive and quiet and not challenging the status quo and, you know, just getting about. And I just thought, yeah, you're right. Like that is a depiction that is something, again, it's one of those things that is sat in the back of your subconscious. And I thought, yeah, that's in me too. I think I've even felt that just, you know, subconsciously. But then it goes back to that the point you mentioned about, and of course, you know me, like we've agreed on it. There's racism against anyone is awful. And I fully stand by that. And we all knew this was going to happen. The minute it was an outbreak from China, yeah, that's it. You know, the memes start instantly.
Yeah.
Which, of course, they would never start from Italy. And I don't think I've seen anything about any other place in the world. And the fact that Italy has way surpassed China and not seen nothing but love and respect for the Italians and the love from all over the world for Italy. I didn't see that love for China. All I saw from China towards China was racist memes, racist jokes, eco-fascism and blame.
Yeah, huge blame.
Blame. Having said that, where have Asians in general, Southeast, wherever, where has there been an active presence from Asians to stand up for our Black brothers and sisters? Where has that been before now? And so I think that's a very legitimate feeling of agitation and upset, really, you know, from particularly for Black women. Black men too, but especially for Black women. Black women and women of colour in general tend to be the ones that do race work. I haven't come across so many men of colour doing it to the depths that I think I've seen women of colour doing it. But that, I'm not saying that.
I mean, I know that they're there. I guess, you know, how they show up might be differently, but it definitely feels like there are more women doing this. Well, there's certainly, in terms of who is coming to do my courses and do the work, it's also
always
mostly women. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, again, on the board of even when you talk about white people doing the work, it's white women that are doing the work.
Yeah.
I'm yet to see my following of 11K has 9% men. And that has remained consistent from when it was 1,000 people to 11,000.
Yeah.
It's never got to 10% men. 91% women. Yeah, I think it's a very legitimate feeling to feel, I don't even know if jaded is the word, but just let down, I think, by...
How do you think we address that? Because we all know, like, it's unspoken, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Certainly not between us. We talk about whatever.
Yeah.
How do we start to address that within our own communities, that healing and that feeling of, I don't know if I'm safe with you in the room. I don't know if you're going to form an alliance for self-preservation or for whatever it is. Like, we've all been, you know, targets of the same victimization because of who we cannot help but be. But yet there are these layers where that hate turns on each other. It's a big question. I'm not expecting you to answer it, but you know, there is definitely some conversations that need to be had.
I think that is the power of where all of this lies, is in having those conversations. And the problem is when it comes between those of us that are different races, not white, but Black and brown and Indigenous cultures, and the things that we've got to dismantle within our communities, that becomes harder because of the fact that we've all been subject to white supremacy.
Yeah.
And that even though there is still a hierarchy there or a something there in terms of who has experienced most from not only white people, but from other people of colour, whilst that is there, there is also the harm that we can cause each other, regardless of what our race is, because of white supremacy.
Yes.
So there could be somebody who is really keen on making amends there, but then getting not attacked, but having someone from another race being like, get stuffed and maybe, I don't know, exhibiting traits from white supremacy against that person. And then there's those conflicts that keep happening within our own communities.
Yeah.
Those things are heartbreaking because we know the ugly grandparent of white supremacy is still winning.
Yeah.
But having said that, I can't speak for all
of course
South Asian people or all people of colour, but I have openly put myself from a very young age in those conversations and openly been around any of my friends that are, in fact, it's not even just so around my Black friends. I've been privy to those conversations. I've sat in them. I've said I'm able to take it and hold it, and I'm humbling myself in it because, and also there's no ego there from me. Like, I'm not lying to myself and thinking that, you know, this utopian connection that we all have. Like, yeah, we've had, there was a saying about that as well, something about, because our struggles aren't the same, they're similar, but it's a good saying. Our struggles have been similar, but they've also been different. Yeah. And there's also been ways in which that has to be acknowledged and respected and space kept for that, because otherwise then it's fake. Mm. If an Asian person, for example, was coming to be like, oh yeah, you know, we've got the same troubles as black people and blah, blah, blah. Well, you haven't.
And vice versa.
But there is definitely enough there for us to be united in more than there is a reason for us to be divided. Mm. And there's also something to mention for what Muslim people are facing.
Mm.
And then black Muslims. Everything's
compounded, isn't it?
So compounded.
Everything is compounded.
So compounded. And that in itself, like I'm Sikh. Yeah. And so Sikhs and Muslims have had beef.
Huge conflict.
Centuries. And I grew up being a kid in the 90s, having a very conscious awareness that I can absolutely not bring a Muslim boy home.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. No way. And nobody ever sat me down over. Nobody ever said to me this wasn't allowed. And again, as a child, I remember thinking, but that isn't who we are.
It didn't make sense to you as a child.
It didn't make any sense. And yeah. It still doesn't make any sense to me now. I remember that, like, Sikhi is oneness. It's the human race it was founded on oneness and equality. And the thing is, with our faith, it blends in with culture very much. So even people that aren't religious, it's still kind of, that's the ethos, you know? And so I'm like, so how does that make sense if all of a sudden, and I remember challenging other Indian kids at my school, and they would say, like, well, yeah, but you know, you would be able to marry a Muslim kid, yeah, as long as we get older. And I'd be like, well, what about Naz? What about Ahmed? Like, you know, and they'd be like, oh, but they're different. And I'm like, and I'd cling on to it. I'd be like, why? Why are they different? There's me as a 10-year-old in the playground getting deep while everyone else is playing one of the words. And they wouldn't be able to tell me.
Of course not, because it's not logical. It is nothing about it is logical, nothing about racism, nothing about it's none of it is logical.
No. And so that's something as well. Although I have to say, as we've got older, I definitely felt that more in the 90s. And then remember, I came from a very, very non-diverse town where the only diversity was Indian people, and then the odd one or two Pakistanis. And my thing that I always used to say as a kid was, but Pakistan was India.
Yeah.
And like Bangladesh, it was all India. We were all one. I still don't. And that's not to disrespect that Pakistan has its own culture now. And they are, I mean, considering it's been 70 years, they have created the most beautiful culture that almost feels like that has been around for centuries in itself, and that's super new. So it's not discrediting the beautiful culture that they have, but underneath all of that, we are all from India. It's just a line drawn by some rich white British man over a lunch. Can I tell you, it was over a lunch that happened. They split up India into three bits.
And over a lunch meeting.
Over a lunch, cash. And that has affected, I mean, like my granddad, he was born in the part of India that is now Pakistan.
Yeah.
So what do you call us? You know, like what, and what do you call him? And he always, I'd say my granddad, perhaps that's where I always got my centeredness around oneness and equality and recognizing the human race as one from such a young age, because he was the oldest in the family. He was the first one to come over from India, and he never once strayed from oneness. His heart is just so pure, so pure. And when people would talk about Muslims and Sikhs and Hindus, you know, not all getting on, he would just say, "But," "But" means darling. He'd just be like, "But we all live together. We all lived in different roads and villages all around each other. How can I say to you, you can't come home with a Muslim boy? My neighbour was, my best friend was a Muslim boy. And so whilst that wouldn't have been across the community when I was younger at all, and I'm just being really real, there'll be people probably listening to this being like, that's not true. And that was that was my experience. And I'm pretty sure across the board, people would remember that feeling.
Parts of
and,
it, yeah.
And I also think it's probably the same the other way around for Muslims too. It was, you know, don't go near Hindus and Sikhs. And in my head, as a young kid, nobody said it to me, nothing. I was just like, but we were all one before that. And that's all that matters. And so again, that fracturing, that dividing, that conquering, those hierarchies.
We're all victims of the same system that doesn't serve any of us.
No. And that makes me crack up sometimes. That those that uphold white supremacy, it's not serving you either.
Well, they think that it is.
It ain't serving you. Your life is so half lived.
Yeah.
It's so half lived. There's no richness. There's no depth of connection. It's so, you're so cut off from that which it means to have a human experience.
And it's also, it's also, I feel like white supremacy lives in a place of scarcity and fear that, well, what happens when they get the power?
Oh my God.
We'll be like them, and I don't want that to happen, so I'm going to cling on to this for dear life. And again, most of this is not conscious. Scarcity.
And lack mindset.
It's infinite.
And it's so bonkers where that even came from, because that's an idea they planted inside their own head. Because not one, and this is something my friends and I talk about a lot. You know, we were out here in Asia, in Africa, chilling with our gold and our jewels and our silks and our fabrics and our spices and all of our abundance and Mother Earth and all of that. Not once were we interested in going over to dusty old England to be like, what can we up and steal from there? No, mate, we were happy. There was no other culture that wanted to do that, like, in that way. Like, It was, okay, you had other empires have been formed, of course, right? And that's always the colonialist apologists always say, well, if, you know, Britain didn't do it, then Russia would have done it, or, you know, somebody would have done it, and it could have been worse.
How do you know?
It could have been a lot worse. And, you know, be grateful the British did it.
Be grateful for the impact of 400 plus years. Of mass genocide, colonization.
I'm just like, poor bastards, man.
This is how Yazzie and I talk about white supremacy. So for me, like, this work needs to have lightness to it. It's not to take it deeply, deeply serious, and the impacts of it are palpable, but it needs lightness, otherwise, you know.
100%. Because it is a madness. Like, really?
When you say it like that, that's why some people say that whiteness is literally a form of psychosis.
Mate, there is not a true word said. Whiteness is a psychosis. And I do always, I feel like every time I say that, I have to constantly remind people, whiteness is a mindset.
Yes.
It's not you as an individual.
Yes.
But whiteness as a mindset is absolutely a psychosis, because it's delusional. It is 100% delusional to have a mindset of whiteness and call that sanity. It's not sanity. I often say we're living in insanity, because we're living in the imagined constructs that white man created.
Very much imagined, very much a form of assumptions, hallucinations, illogical at times.
Mm-hmm. The fear of a black planet, all of that crap.
There was a black planet mean?
Oh, yeah, the fear of a black planet is actually a heading in one of Renée Edelodge's book, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, the Anti-Racism Bible. Mm-hmm. And in there, she refers to Enoch Powell's disgusting speech from about 50 years ago. And we were just saying how 50 years ago is
not long.
It just hits home when you hear it like that, doesn't it? You know, 50 years ago, that makes my breath just catches in my throat when you think about how fresh we are on this. Enoch Powell actually said in that speech, and this is something that has been continually perpetuated. In this country, in 50 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man. And that's that fear. And that's that fear again, that they've created that fear. When was that ever something that was a possibility of happening? That was when you think about a sociopath and you think about what they have done to somebody, perhaps, and you think about a sociopath's worst fear would be somebody doing to them what they have done to others.
Yeah.
And that's what white supremacy is. It has created this fear of, oh my God, the worst thing that could possibly happen to me
is what we've done to others.
What we've done to others. And for that fear to be alive, even though nobody from the others has come out to say, we want that done to you. Like, for example, India have only had independence for 70-something years, 71, 72. And they have asked for an apology from Britain. That's all they've asked for, right? Apologies. And they've also asked for things like the Koninor diamond to be returned and all the rest of the
from
stuff.
From where it was stolen.
And the answer has always been no. And we're still awaiting an apology. Just an apology. Not we want to take over your country. Not we want to come over there and do what you did to us. An apology.
Okay. It's just, it's so simple. It's so simple. It's for me, it's the acknowledgement.
Yeah.
We don't even acknowledge what we did to each other and the impact that continues to have on individuals from certain minorities, ethnic minorities, socioeconomic circumstances.
Yes, absolutely.
The way we're viewed, the way we treat each other, there's just no acknowledgement. And I think to me, that's the most painful thing.
100%. And
we all just want to live in bloody peace.
Yes, I say that so often. Nobody wants peace and equality more than BIPOC.
Yeah.
That's it.
And maybe nobody some reparations.
Yes. I mean, can we please just remember that reparations were still being paid out to white people who lost slaves up until 2015.
In the UK, yeah. Taxpayers were paying that back.
2015. As reparations. I mean, the fact that the word reparation doesn't automatically, in most people's heads, in this day and age, the word reparation means money going back to families that were devastated by slavery and colonialism, right? But instead, what that word actually meant was giving white people money, white people who were slave owners, giving them compensation
for the fact that they no longer had access to free labour. It's mind-blowing.
I don't have the words. I don't even have the thought capacity to understand it. I don't.
But that's what we're dealing with.
Yes.
That's what we're dealing with. And, you know, it's big work. And I personally think there is a time. I personally will not be doing this work forever.
Absolutely not.
How you feel,
no. Absolutely not. I have too much joy in my life to be spending my whole life doing this. No way.
Yeah. But for the moment, we're serving. So, you know, if you're listening to this, it means you're one of those people that care about being part of the solution. So, you know, do the work. You know, we're here to serve at the moment, but there is a cost for us in our body and mind doing this work.
Yes.
So now is the time to act. It couldn't be more urgent. It could not be more urgent.
One thing I think that is really important to remember is that, honestly, white people, you're taking too long.
Mm.
You are too slow.
Mm.
It's not that hard to get. It's not that hard to grasp. It's been going on for centuries. How much longer do you need? And that is also a thing for people of privilege to consider, because the fact that this isn't at the top of people's list means that
it
is
will
a
be.
Yeah. If this is something that you're going to get to at some point and you don't see the urgency of it now, means that you're not really an ally.
You're not, not really an ally. You are not an ally.
You're not an ally. And I don't mean that in an offensive or a rude way, or even I'm not condemning anybody in any way. I'm just saying in a factual basis, this isn't something on anyone's to-do list. This is part and parcel of your daily life.
Yeah.
If you really do live what you speak, how much longer? How many more people need to die? How much more injustice do you need to see? Have you not had enough?
How much more evidence? I always say every day of inaction is another day of harm, and it couldn't be more palpable now. I've had so many people over the coming weeks say, now's not the time to talk about racism. We've got more pressing things. You try dealing with a global pandemic and racism on top and the impact socioeconomically. The fact that you don't acknowledge or even have any idea that these two things are intrinsically linked just shows how far down the rabbit hole you are. And again, no shame. That's a fact. It should be part of who we are as human beings. And I have people who are engaging in this work. I don't know about you, Yazzie, who come out the other side of my course and they say, this work is me. It's not, it's now not something they're doing on a weekend. They're like, it is me. And they are allying every it's part of who they become. Yes. It's no extra work. It's no extra effort. It's who they are. It's who they become.
Oh, you're just giving me goosebumps. That is exactly it. That's exactly it. And that, I don't know how to express the feeling of when this pandemic started, my first feeling, like that drop in my stomach was, this is going to mean people don't think that race has any place now to be spoken about. And in my mind, I was like, there is no more important time. Because we are where we are because the systems we live in weren't already set up to be ready for something like this. And the reason things weren't set up for us to be ready is because we live in a white supremacist world. You know, we've been cut off from community. We've been cut off. This is what I mean when I say that when whiteness itself as a mindset thinks it serves itself, even it doesn't. Everyone's getting hurt by this.
Of course.
There's no community in this country. When was the last time you felt community spirit in this country? I would say 2012 Olympics.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That was the last time.
Also the year I got married. So yeah, I had a good year of community.
2012 was a brilliant year. Love that year. But again, Nova, that was your wedding. That was a community that you've created.
Yeah.
You've created that. I can't remember feeling solid community other than on the streets in the 90s when I was a kid. That's when I think about real community in this country. That's the last time I really felt it. And since then, I felt it incredibly strongly in refugee camps where people, I can't even begin to explain. And actually watching those people try and come to this country and having to say to them, you know, I don't know what you've been told about the UK, but it isn't a loving place. I don't describe this place as loving anymore. It's not. You know, you get love from your circle, you get love from people around you, but you don't get love from a wider society. Everyone's left to fend for themselves. And that's something that has led me to have really horrible issues with anxiety. And living in a world that you can palpably feel doesn't care about the whole.
Yes.
That to me, that hurts my spirit. And yet, when I go to other countries, I can palpably feel a sense of community in other countries. I can. And their countries of culture and their countries of colour. And that's just facts. Again, I'm not, you know, I'm born and bred here. I love my Britishness. I love my British sense of humour. I am a British. But I don't feel that sense of love and community.
And I don't think you'll be isolated. You know, I have friends who are white and British who say the same thing. So when this sort of hit and really sort of the weight of the current circumstances hit me, first there was fear and panic and not knowing what's going to happen afterwards. And then there was a moment where I felt a little bit excited. Not that we're going to have to go through this, and that we're going to lose people we love, or that we're going to be separated from people we love, but that at the other side of it, there is opportunity for monumental change.
100%. I can only second every single bit of that. And that is, I was saying it, I was on the BBC Radio London last night, and I was saying to them, and it's funny because I got immediately... not accused, but they were like, oh my God, no, only positivity. And I was like, here you go with the
unicorns and rainbows.
Actually, the unicorns and rainbow brigade in the middle of a pandemic. And that's great, yes. But I wasn't being negative. I was actually being positive. But with
and being truthful.
Positivity is truth, yeah. And saying that this is our last chance as a human species to get things together and to honour and prioritise, like we have never done before, humility and vulnerability and fierce love, fierce love, you know, kinship, recognising the human race as one. All of those things are now vital, and they have always been vital for our survival. This is the point.
Yeah.
Never at any point has this not been vital. But if you cannot see, like even if you look at it on a really basic level, we need each other to survive this. We need our hospital staff. We need our supermarket staff. We need our delivery drivers. We need our cleaners. We need our porters. We need all of the very people that you know, a few months ago were just regarded as low-skilled workers.
Yeah.
And we need those for the whole to survive, and that we should be doing everything we can to make sure that they stay healthy, that their mental health is protected, that, you know, we're all in a position here to give something.
And we are literally doing that
by
staying home.
Yes.
Like we all have to do that to help each other.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so for me, that was something that, yes, as much as this is scary and I'm as scared as the next person and we don't have answers for anything yet, but I know that the universe is smart. And if we live on a planet so intricately designed in the way that it is, that this hasn't happened without a bigger thing at play here. And I believe it is it's our chance, our opportunity, like you said, to make sure we start living in the ways that nurture and allow humanity to thrive in a way that doesn't hurt each other and doesn't hurt the planet. And it's very, very possible.
Yeah.
It's very possible. We've just been taught and conditioned and raised in systems that are toxic and harmful.
Yeah.
But equally, none of those things can last forever. Nothing lasts forever.
Yeah.
So now is the time.
Now is the time. I'm going to ask you two more questions and then I'm going to sadly have to say goodbye. How do you find calm within chaos? And what do you want the world to look like at the other side of this? How do you want things to be different, even if it's just the start of that change?
Firstly, you are an excellent questioner. Excellent. I have not enjoyed a podcast interview as much as this one ever.
Oh,
this has been wonderful. There are a few ways. The first way that I've been finding lately, and actually before the pandemic, I was coming out of really chronic generalized anxiety, and I've never had it before to that extent. I've never really had anxiety before to levels that you would call extreme.
Yeah.
I just had the normal amounts, and birdsong brought me back to myself. Ooh. This year. Birdsong.
Wow.
As cliche as that might sound, it was in January, and I started to hear, I was having a not very good day. And it was always the morning. My anxiety came in the morning, which felt so cruel because I was going to sleep and I would sleep well, which I was very grateful for. But I'd wake in the morning and all that peace would be gone. And I knew that I was going to be waking up to that raging, anxious bull. And yeah, it was a really horrible feeling to know that, right, I'm going to have to start my day like this again. And I was wrestling with all those horrible, anxious thoughts. And then I heard a bird outside my window. And Nova, it cut through all of it, cut through the cloud, the fog, the pain, straight to my heart. It's one of those things that hasn't got words. I haven't got words. It was the feeling that saved me.
Wow.
And then I started to notice it again throughout the day. And then the next morning, and then the next morning. And I was building on it without even realizing. But birdsong saved me this year.
Wow.
And so right now, literally, birdsong is still, it's the joy. Like, look how joyful that is. Like when you hear them, they're so happy. and I just feel, and this goes the same for spring, because now that we've entered spring, like watching blossoms bloom and watching like birds play in the trees and seeing that there is a world where there is joy and we are that close to it. Therefore, I can exist in that reality at the same time as knowing that this giant pandemic is going on.
Yeah.
You know, nature hasn't stopped. Look at her. And she's been here long before we have.
Yeah.
And the sun always rises. And the moon always comes up. They're never late. Every day. And that has been my solid anchor, I think, in life anyway. Even if I'm not able to go out and enjoy it in the way I normally would, like spring is my favorite time, and still just knowing it's going on, looking out the window, that has been my calm in the chaos.
Wow, stunning. And also reminds me of that four-year-old girl you talk about and her wonderment, and I can see it. Yeah, I have the pleasure of being able to see Yazzie now. Okay, and part B of that question. What do you want the world to look like, or how do you want things to start changing at the end of this?
Honestly, my biggest hope and wish is that this will become a mass awakening for a lot of people. That perhaps they were already thinking about these things, but they realise the urgency now. And then it will create a mass mindset shift to be going back to basics.
Yeah.
To be honouring a pace of slowness. Like, I'm not going to lie, I haven't found the quarantine part of this hard to manage. I'm in a privileged position of, I don't have children, because I think when you're a parent, God, you need the outside and you need to be out and doing stuff with them. And that is something that's really hard. But for somebody who is self-employed, who does gigs and talks and speeches and events left, right and center, and rights, and come home, and, like, you know, being so fast paced all that time, and actually begging the world to slow down, and now we're here. I think that that honoring of that slowness is important. We couldn't sustain the rate we were going.
No,
like, something had to give, and if this is it, great. Like, let's practice more slowness. So that's something I really hope actually stays. And a really, really basic understanding that there is no way that the systems we were living in were sustainable anyway.
Yeah.
For everyone to recognize that white supremacist, patriarchal, heteronormativity cycles that we live in, and all the other systems, toxic systems that we're a part of, but ultimately come from, me and my friend call it the three-headed demon: patriarchy, white supremacy, and capitalism.
Yeah. Which are all inextricably linked.
Absolutely. They get seen for what they are.
Yeah.
The three-headed demon gets seen for what it is, and it causes a mass shift of, right, it's now time where people have recognised the individual power that lies within each and every one of us, and not giving it over anymore to toxic systems that keep us separate.
100%. It's a beautiful way to close this. Can you share with my amazing listeners where they can find you, what services you offer, or anything that's coming up that might be of service to them?
So you can get me at Stand for Humanity. That's all in one word, and four is F-O-R, not the number. So Stand for Humanity on Instagram. I don't really hang out on the other platforms because they give me anxiety.
That's just race hate land there.
Can't do it. So Instagram's my playground. And I'm on Patreon as well, which I started recently, and I'm really loving being on there. I feel far more free and less restricted. Because I've been censored quite a lot on Instagram, as you know. Can't type in the words. Literally, the word white has become a swear word, apparently, on Instagram now, because any of my posts that have the word white in it have been flagged. Just giving you education, babes. It's not anything else, but okay. So Patreon, Stand for Humanity on there as well. Soul coaching sessions, which I'm now offering at much more reduced rates. And also pay what you feel at the moment. I am also going to start offering some sessions called Active Hope, which is some work that I've been trained in over the last 6 months. And honestly, it could not be more timely. It's going to have to be online now, which is going to be first time challenge for me. But it's getting people together in group settings to honour the pain that we're in, and being able to go forth and see with new eyes, and root it all in gratitude, but have a space for us to honour our pain, because that's such an important place for us to be able to then, we actually become empowered from it. But because we live in a society that's so, you know, feeling phobic, it stops a lot of that from being able to get through. Lots of stuff actually.
Amazing.
That I offer. But I would say those are the names. And then poetry as well. So type in Yazzy Min into YouTube and you'll get my taste poem on race.
Yazzy, you are absolutely a gift, and I cannot thank you enough. Thank you for everything that you do and for sharing a piece of your heart and your gift.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure to have this chat with you, and definitely up for a part two. I'm honoured actually that I was even asked to be on this, because this work is so much and you do so much, and nothing more gives me more fuel to do this than for other Black Indigenous people of colour.
Wow.
That nothing gives me more fuel. And when we get to connect and support each other and build each other up and know that we're doing this for us, for all of our people, for all people, this is for everyone, for future generations, and knowing I get to look to my left and there's a Nova Reed there, that's massive. So thank you for everything that you do.
Thank you.
Do you remember? Do you remember what all of this is for? The beginning of the end and the start of so much more? Did you forget? Did you forget that the universe loves us? And that is at the core of what keeps us all connected through love and through war. Can you hear it? Can you hear the sigh of relief that your body is making as you let out all that grief? Do you feel it? Do you feel your human sag and surrender, not in defeat, but something more tender, of faith, of hope, of trust? Remember, we were made for these times. No need for pretenders. Because all this is asking is for the realness of humanity, to put an end to these systems where we're trapped in insanity. The universe still loves us. That will always be our reality. But we've been living within constructs that have ripped out our sanity. It's time to fill up these holes, these gaping open cavities, bring back our life. I hope you feel the gravity of the chance we've been given to make sure we heal. Because we've been long-time sufferers of a capitalist ordeal. We've been long-time separated by white supremacist ideals. We've been long-time spinning on this patriarchal wheel. It's our society that's sick and it's been desperate to feel. A birthright to connection that we have been starved of. Our umbilical cord severed from earth with invisible price tags, labelling everything she provides abundantly, turning our first mother into a commodity, whilst distracted with being trapped in the imagination of our captives. It's time to allow spirit to come through and make us reactive to the energy we were born to, instead of remaining inactive, because the fact is, without all of us, there will be none of us. We forget that each moment will end up in the past. So this is history in the making. And we could build a world that lasts, where humility and vulnerability will neutralize the acidity that we have become accustomed to, the bigger virus that we have been sucked into. It will take a commitment of deep love and deep courage. And here we are, writing the prequel, the start of a new earth. The end of profit over people.
Wow, wow, wow.